Welcome to Libertarian Counterpoint. I am your host, James Just. With me today is Mr. Jason McPhee from the Knuckleheads of Liberty. Jason, tonight we're talking mostly about American unhappiness, or what causes unhappiness in general. So we'll kind of discuss that as we go along. But we're going to start with colleges, the cost of college. Colleges cost will be up to $95,000 per semester, not a year, per semester in some of these colleges. And the schools are claiming that financial aid can numb the sticker shock. Well, yeah, if they're giving out grants, but if these schools are giving out grants, why the heck are they charging so much? Why not just lower the prices? Why have to do it with grants? And the government's new FAFSA website, government built a website again, and guess what, Jason? It doesn't work. The FAFSA website is an absolute mess. So if you're a college student and you having to face this, you know, what are you going to do? You got $95,000 a semester. Let's just give them the benefit of the doubt. It's $95,000 for two semesters. We'll give some of these colleges the benefit of the doubt. And you're getting a degree that's worth less because as more degrees get handed out, you know, it's just like anything else. The value of that degree becomes worthless. Not worthless, worth less. Let me be careful how I phrase that.
I think for a lot of them, the unhappiness sets in once they leave college and realizing how much debt they have. That's when the unhappiness sets in. But, you know, I was thinking, man, we could have kicked off the show with just living in California is maybe the cause of unhappiness nowadays.
That's last week's show, Jason. That's last week's show where we're talking about California unhappiness. That's its own thing. But, yeah, it's the cost of college. Has no relations to its value anymore. I mean, if you're in a handful of subjects, right? There's a handful of highly sought after subjects. But if you're the average college student, it's not worth $95,000 a year, especially if you have to go into any type of debt.
Yeah. Well, and that's the key problem that we're facing in so many areas in society is that, as you kind of alluded to, price signals have become detached from all of these different products and services, whether we're talking healthcare, whether we're talking college. There's so much government distortion that people really don't understand exactly what they're getting themselves into in a lot of these things. And college is a key aspect there because, you know, you got to realize most students are sort of propagandized through K-12 that you got to go to college no matter what, you're going to make money no matter what, and yeah, don't worry about the size of the loan, just take out those loans, you know, and oh, by the way, you can't get rid of those through bankruptcy. Yeah.
Well, because you owe it to the government, right?
Yeah,
that's the key. When the government took over the loans, they removed your ability to get out of those loans through bankruptcy, because the government is the greediest group of people you will ever meet. Just go throughout history, and who is the greediest group of people? It's the government, whether it's the king, whether it's the local lord, or whether it's, you know, your president, prime minister, or whatever. Those are the greediest groups of people.
Yeah.
And it's been that way throughout history. And now we've got colleges who, as we're going to talk about a little bit later, the administrative state of each college is essentially, the administration of the colleges is what's is costing so much, and these students don't really realize the actual problem. That's part of the problem. These students, one, they're not given the proper education. They're not being told that, hey, you borrow these $50,000, $60,000, you're paying it back at, I don't know what the college, you're having a daughter going to college. What's the interest rates for loans these years?
We're just finishing high school, so yeah, you're in sticker
that,
shock is coming
That sticker up. Shock is starting to hit in. So what's the interest rate you'd pay if she had to get a loan?
Well, we haven't quite broached that yet. We're still, you know, working on exactly what the plans are getting out, and you know, we're thinking about community college too, just because that would help to offset a lot of the other costs and staying local. But that was one of the better values, at least from my experiences. I wound up going through the local community college system before I transferred over, and it's funny. It's one of the kind of dirty little secrets is that the education is actually better at the community college a lot of times than it is at the university. Most university professors are there to do research, and they're really not that interested in teaching. They've got to publish, and that's, you know, they're really there for other reasons than teaching. But in the community college, a lot of times class size is around 30 or less, and you have much better access to your teachers. a lot of times students and teachers wind up getting to know each other on a first name basis there, whereas, you know, at the, you know, when you're sitting in a hall with 300 students or 200 students at a university, it's a, you know, much more cold experience.
Well, I had the community college. I had two classes at community college, and that's the one thing I did notice is that my teachers, the two teachers I had, they only taught one class. Each one of them only taught one class, mm-hmm. so they knew their class. They had jobs outside of outside of the university. And then I went to online school. I went to Western Governors University for management and marketing, which I found out I'm actually terrible at marketing. I'm good, have good instincts. I just dislike the corporate marketing that they were teaching you. I could not stand it.
Well, you know, the biggest problem with the universities nowadays, and Milton Friedman had a pretty good idea that he put out there on this, and he said that, you know, you really have to tie the fate of the college to the fate of the student, and that'll fix a lot more of this. So he talked about maybe some kind of a strategy where you'd essentially go to school and they would pay for it, but then they'd get a cut out of your income for the rest of your life. But then they're tied to your performance. So they're not going to teach you classes that are worthless. They're going to teach you only classes that they think that have some kind of market return, which is one of the problems we're seeing now. So many students are going there for reasons other than education, but once the college starts getting tied to the outcome of the student, they're going to suddenly start becoming a lot more efficient.
Well, maybe the colleges should be responsible for some of these student loans instead of the government. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. There's some of that.
Or just let the loans be market-based purely and keep the government out of it. And then suddenly it becomes like a business venture. And the you know, you'll go to the bank and you'll say, hey, I really want to study this field and I need this much money. And they're going to look at it and they say,
you've got D's in, you got D's in school. No.
Yeah, yeah.
You want to get a plumbing truck? You know,
or maybe underwater basket weaving really isn't likely to be able to pay back that loan.
Yeah. I'll pay for your class in advanced chemistry, but I'm not paying for your basket weaving class. Yeah. Right? Yeah, these are the kind of things that a loan officer would
sure.
make a decision.
And that's the great thing about the market is maybe there's some rare cases where a basket weaving class might work, but the market will figure that out through competition. Some guy who's sitting at the top, like, you know, Biden or somebody else making the choices, that's likely to lead us into a deep, deep hole, which is where we're at right now.
Yes, yeah, so we're going to move on to our second topic, and it's actually quite related. Gen Z is, they're not sure if higher education is worth it. They're looking at these numbers that we're just, and this reality. We're looking at the numbers and then the reality of the value of that degree, and they're going, I can learn what I need to learn on YouTube. I can learn what I need to learn through a mentorship or through going out and actually just doing things. And that's more valuable than wasting my 4 years in college and coming out with debt. And so they're starting to make this economic decision that says, no, it's not worth it right now. Until the prices come down or until the value of the degree comes up, we're not going to go down this path. We're not going to make the same mistakes that the people 5 years ago were making and coming out of school with $100,000, $200,000 in debt and no way to pay it off.
Sure. And this is one of the other interesting things about, you know, the market's influence right now that we're starting to see too is you're starting to get CEOs like people like Elon Musk and others who are fairly prominent and have a large voice, and they're saying, hey, we're really not sure that these degrees are really adding value. And so we're not really sure that we're going to really use these to filter people as they apply for our company, because we're thinking maybe that's not a great indicator of what a great asset you're going to be when you come here.
Well, especially when you're talking about like computer programming, because realistically, the best computer programmers are ones who teach themselves. Because what happens in school is they teach you what not to do. Mm-hmm. And so instead of thinking outside the box, instead of doing something unique and creative, you just do what you were told, this is how you do it. And it's those who teach themselves, those who don't know that you're not supposed to be able to do this, that you shouldn't do it this way, who try it and then succeed.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned what not to do, but they also tie on so many extra things of, I guess, extra baggage that you may never need in a lot of these degrees as well. I know one of the big things in California, both in high school and in college, is they have all these foreign language requirements. Now, for some people, a foreign language may be a great thing to do in college, and it may actually add a lot of value to some business degrees and other things. But to just say that you make some top-down edict that every person needs to spend time in, to me, the best second language to learn is mathematics. I think we'd all be a lot better if if people came out essentially fluent in mathematics.
Well, and the difficulty in that one is not everybody has the, as my German teacher in high school told me, you don't have a tongue for languages, right? I could read German, but I could not speak it to save my life. And so I don't have a, she said, you don't have a tongue for languages. And not everybody has that, right? Some people can speak 7-8 languages and they pick them up quickly. There's others, like me, who simply cannot pick up a foreign language to save my life, right? I guess if I was immersed in it and you had to literally save your life, you would eventually learn. Oh my God, but it would be embarrassing for the first 2 years. It would be awful.
Well, did your German teacher admonish you in something that sounded like some World War II accent? You know,
no, she was very kind. She was very kind. She actually let me be her TA assistant for the second half of my second year of German 1. Because I was that bad. So not all of us can speak a foreign language.
You know, I know that there's a university that's starting in Texas or somewhere like that. It's a whole bunch of more classical liberal types are trying to get this together. And one of the things they're talking about to bring costs down as well is getting rid of some of this fluff and turning a lot of these 4-year degrees into 3-year degrees. And that would actually do wonders for kids and the debt that they come out of school with.
At the risk of throwing the control room into confusion, I'm skipping from the fields for a second. We're going to go. West Virginia University is a description. We're talking about education. So West Virginia University, they have laid off 32 educational staff. I think it was 32. They're laying off educational staff. They're cutting educational programs, and a bunch of students are upset. Now they're laying off. Oh, what was it? Humanities. There is a graphic for this. I was hoping they would put it up for me. But I'll see if I can do it by memory. I'll see if I can remember it. But
just project for us.
Yeah. They can see it up there. If you can see it, can you read that for me, Jason? Can you see that bottom half?
I'm sorry. I'd have to get my glasses.
No. All right. So we're just going to have to go through it. So they're laying off staff. They're cutting humanities classes. You know, the not hard science classes. They're closing some of those. And of course, the people who take those classes are upset. But the question is, why are they cutting classes and not the administration? And there is an answer to that, but let's see if what you've got, you know, is cutting classes, cutting academic classes, even if they're the less popular ones or the less scientifically rigorous ones, are those the classes to cut when you're talking about trying to balance budgets for a university, for a relatively small university?
Well, I know I didn't quite read all of the article, but I did see something about them saying, oddly, some of these classes that, you know, would have been the usual suspects for not having a return, some of them actually, they claim, were doing fairly well. So I don't know, but this is the beauty of letting markets figure this stuff out and getting the government out of it. A lot of this stuff will just work its way out.
Well, you know, the reason that the administrative side of these universities have grown is actually government mandates, whether it's Title IX, Title VII, yeah. pick your educational mandate. They have to have, you know, processes in place to deal with all these political preferences that the political class wants to impose on colleges. And so that requires staff, and that requires people to take care of those staff, right? Staff to manage the staff. And so when you ask why has the administrative state of colleges grown, it's just like everything else. As bureaucracy grows, it forces the bureaucracy of the regulated industries to grow with it, because you have to comply. And so those compliance comes with costs. And in this case, the cost is actually in educational programs.
Yeah. And I imagine, too, a lot of these different rules also, I guess, deter startup colleges as well, just like we see in the rest of the market. You know, if you get some big car company or somebody else, and then some little guy wants to start, like in the movie Tucker, I guess, is a good example of that, you know, where this guy decided he wanted to build a car, and boy, I tell you, they threw every roadblock in his way, including politicians.
Yeah, it takes someone like Elon Musk to start a college now, someone who's one of the richest people in the world. They can start a college, but if you and I wanted to start a college with one class in a rented room someplace, it'd be very difficult for us to even do that. All right, so now Mr. Richard Fields was talking about countries that trade with each other are less likely to fight with each other as kind of the grand scheme of this. So let's see what Richard Fields has to say this week.
Hi, this is Richard Fields with Reports from the Fields. Tariffs are a tax. They are almost always paid by consumers in the country levying the tariffs. 6 years ago, then-President Trump enacted tariffs on the import of Chinese goods. President Biden has kept them in place and even extended them. American consumers are paying for them in higher prices on goods, either higher prices on the same goods produced in America at higher cost, or higher costs due to the tariff itself and extra transportation costs of goods shipped from China to Mexico and then overland to the United States. Oh yeah, you probably did not know that trade between China and Mexico has gone up 60% since the Trump tariffs. You didn't think there was a sudden 60% increase in Mexico demand for iPhones, did you? Who benefits? Well, supposedly workers making the now more expensive Chinese goods domestically. But that's not how it worked out. A 2021 study by the U.S.-China Business Council found that the real result was the loss of 245,000 American jobs. Theoretically, U.S. manufacturers protected from Chinese competition would benefit. The actual result is that with a protected market, they just get fatter and lazier. That makes them uncompetitive in the export market. Ask U.S. Steel, the former juggernaut, which tried in desperation to sell itself to Nippon Steel, a Japanese company. Tariffs also have the inevitable consequence of inviting retaliation. China imports a lot of soybeans from the U.S. It's nearly as easy to import them from Brazil or Argentina. Instead of buying airplanes from Boeing, they can buy them from Airbus or Embraer, with the added bonus that the doors probably won't fall off. Another less immediate drawback to tariffs is increased hostility between nations, which can lead to war. You may remember that when trade between China and the United States was burgeoning and growing every year, there was little talk on the part of China of forcibly annexing Taiwan. Post-tariffs, there is. When your largest trading partner becomes your third largest trading partner in a matter of a few short years, there is less incentive for efforts to emphasize peace in foreign policy and more incentive to be aggressive, because what is there to lose? From China's standpoint, the United States is militarily overextended by its support for the wars in Ukraine, Israel, and the extended Middle East. They may think that now is the time to strike to bring Taiwan back into the fold. The geopolitical lesson is that countries that trade with each other are less likely to fight with each other. When politicians are trying to build a coalition of the economically illiterate and the xenophobic, tariffs and trade wars can help get them elected. But that's only in the short run. I'm Richard Fields, and that's this week's Report from the Fields. See you again next week.
Thank you, Richard. You know, as we get back and we talk about how why Americans and why we're all so unhappy these days, you know, Richard brought up a good point. Those that trade with each other don't fight with each other. You have less motivation to fight with somebody when your mutual benefit, when it mutually benefits both of you. Man, that is a terrible way to phrase that. When a mutually beneficial arrangement can be made where you can both benefit instead of fighting with each other, and or in this particular, you know, as we're talking about the cost of colleges and American unhappiness, you know, we've got $34 trillion in debt, ever-growing government, credit card debt is up, college debt is up, housing costs are through the roof. And we're asking ourselves why Americans are unhappy. It's, you know, it's a pretty self-explanatory question if you ask me.
Well, just wait until they understand what $34 trillion in debt means to the average taxpayer. You can actually go up to debtclock.org. You should check that out in the audience. And they actually have a running clock that keeps track of that. And if they attributed that to just everybody in the population, it's like over $100,000 in debt per person. And when you only figure in just taxpayers, it's like around $200,000. So I mean, we're talking like fantasy land levels of debt as far as ever getting paid back, which means we're in for some hurt at some point.
Which is why they needed inflation, right? So they can pay back some of that old debt with deflated dollars.
Yeah.
And so that's the whole kind of point of monetary policy, is that they're trying to pay off old debt, you know, with dollars that are worth less. But the problem is that we now have to go off and buy bananas with dollars that are worth less. Yeah. A lot of people are complaining about how these, you know, corporations are having record profits, but it's not the same, because you might be having record profits, but if the dollar is worth less, you actually could be having less value out of those record profits than you would before. It's just like, you know, if you have a $100,000 salary, last year you could buy all kinds of stuff with it. Now this year, because of inflation, you need $130,000 to have the same lifestyle. And that same thing works with these businesses that are getting record profits. They're not necessarily record profits, or sometimes these profits are just made just because they've moved money around, they've took advantage of a short-term financial investment, and these profits will evade next year.
A tax loss one year, and then making it seem bigger a different year. You get back to the point where, just like with colleges, when you let the government control the money supply and play with it, pretty much when you let the government control anything, it leads to a lot of unhappiness in the future, but people don't see that in the short term. It's one of those long-term effects usually.
And it's very difficult to get people to focus on that long-term effect, because it's not so evident, right? It's one of those things that's kind of a hidden, you know, those hidden market forces, but they're not hidden. You just have to be trained to look for them. And so we're talking about training to look for things. The FBI, we've seen this, the FBI agent has, FBI went to a person's house the other day, and we're finding out this is happening more and more often than any of us would like to believe. They went to someone's house because of what they posted on social media. They didn't post a threat, they didn't post anything, they simply complained about the current president. And so the FBI agent says he hassles people every day, all day, over their Facebook posts, over their social media posts. And the most disturbing thing, as we talked about just before, Jason, I'm going to steal your thunder, is that when she asked for their ID, they would refuse to show it, claiming that they'd already shown it. But even if they already had, why couldn't she look at it again?
Yeah, it was when she happened to be using her camera to record the conversation was when they weren't forthcoming with their IDs, which is really alarming when you're sitting there. But again, this smacks almost of like China social credit scores or something else, where the government is literally paying attention to what you're doing in private, you know, social media, essentially the public square, and they're essentially coming and hassling you, you know, saying, well, why are you unhappy? You need to be more happy about our current president.
Yeah, you need to be more happy about the current state of our government affairs and what we're doing. And it's just, that's kind of the scary thing for those of us in the civil liberties movement, right? This is actually far scarier than it appears, because, well, they're just bothering you. But no, that having the FBI show up at your house is like having the IRS show up at your house. Even if you've done nothing wrong, it's a traumatic event.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's kind of telling too, because RFK Jr. was recently on an interview in CNN, and he was asked, or he was talking with the host, and the question came up about Trump being an existential threat, because according to CNN, Colt News Network, and MSDNC, Trump is always an existential threat according to them. But RFK actually gave an interesting answer. He said, actually, in his perspective, he could make an argument, he said, that Biden is a bigger threat. And the reason he said is because we've never seen a government essentially using, weaponizing, we've never seen a president who's weaponizing the government to silence people. And that really is. I mean, we saw a Ministry of Truth at Homeland Security that almost happened. And if it wasn't for this Nina Jankowicz that they tried to put in there, who you might remember her from literally singing to supercalifragilisticexpialidocious how she wanted to, what she thought were the threats of disinformation and misinformation, it was pretty alarming.
Yeah. All right, so we've got like 3.5 minutes, so we're going to move on to our last topic. There's been this sense that social media is driving a teen mental health crisis, whether it's TikTok, Facebook, pick your social media platform. But there's been a growing sense that social media is part of a problem with this mental health crisis with kids. But the reality is the data doesn't back that up. And for those of us who study kind of human history, you know, there was a time when the same thing that they're saying now about social media is harming kids. They said it about books. They said it about radio. They said it about rock and roll. They said it about movies and TV. And so now this is just the latest version of the fear of, you know, you're fearing that they're going to learn something. They're going to, I don't know what people are afraid of. Yeah. But it has never worked out in history that this is the problem, yeah. That the modern communication is the problem, right? Whether it's a telephone, everything has been the cause of young people angst. But yet the reality is youth is always in angst. It's because you're transitioning from a child to an adult, and it's very difficult and scary.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, it does make me think back to that story about the Gutenberg Bible. And one of the things that as this story goes, as I've heard it, that the church was worried about is when everybody is able to read the Bible for themselves, and they don't have to have it dictated to them. And so that was considered to be, I guess, one of the things they were really concerned about, is to have that translated into the common tongue. So.
Yeah, because you don't want people thinking for themselves. So that's really what it is. The problem is that us old people forget to realize that we went through this. We forget that we went through the same problems, right? That we had the same issues. Yes, they're different, but they're not, right? History doesn't repeat itself, but it does echo, right? And so while it's not the same, the details are different. But the fundamentals underneath are really the same. These kids are having to adapt to new technologies, to new ways of communication, to a lifestyle that we as old people don't know how to help them navigate, because we're learning too. Mm-hmm. And they're actually going to be the ones who navigate it, who are going to be learn to navigate this new world, not us. Well, I think it's our problem, I think. It's not theirs.
Well, I think what it comes down to a lot of times is, as long as people are left to face the cost of their choices. Some people will make bad choices with all this stuff, but then they will be lessons for everybody else to help keep everybody else on the straight and narrow. And that's literally how we've evolved as a society. You know, we don't need some big planner to set it up for us. We can all just sort of go based upon what we saw of the lesson of the past or the recent past.
Yeah, the real dangers of this is that it continues the victimization. Right, you're teaching these young kids that they're victims of social media, and that's not good for their long-term mental health. All right, we are out of time. Thank you, Jason, for being here with you. Thank you, Inside, for working so hard tonight. And we want to thank you for watching. Please remember to love everybody, and good night.
We left on a very unhappy note.